I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
80,000 Iranians are packed into a soccer stadium in Tehran at this hour watching a game. It's expected that when the game is over, another protest will break out. Yesterday, hundreds of Iranian students and their supporters poured into the streets of Tehran in the third night of demonstrations against the hardline fundamentalist Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The protests have led to clashes with paramilitary thugs and fears that Iran's fragile reform movement might suffer a setback. Joining us on the line from Tehran is Nazili Fati. She reports on Iran from the New York Times. Nazila, welcome.
Hi.
Tell us, what prompted this week of protests?
The first demonstration was over privatizing universities, which was held at the dormitory of Tehran University in central Tehran. But then opposition TV stations based in Los Angeles called on people to join the students, and actually, the protests have been getting larger and larger.
And more violent.
Absolutely right, yeah.
Well, tell us, as it started with privatizing universities, what are the students chanting and saying now?
Well, it's hard to tell if it's the students now chanting, because they've been joined by so many other people from outside the university, and it's many of the students have no idea where and when the next day demonstration is going to be held.
So it's very unorganized, but we do read that some of the protesters are chanting death to Khamenei, a reference to Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme religious leader. And we know that that kind of a statement can lead to a jail sentence. This is pretty risky business, isn't it?
It's extremely risky. The slogans have become very strong, and that's why protesters are being attacked by vigilantes, probably.
Tell us about the vigilantes who we hear are riding around on motor scooters and cornering and attacking some of the students.
There is not a large number of these vigilantes, but they are certainly very powerful because they've got their sticks, they've got their chains, and they're not afraid of beating people.
Yeah.
And people are very much vulnerable with the riot police and these vigilantes attacking them every once in a while.
Mm.
And so it's very hard to tell on the streets who is more in control. The control of intersections is very much switching back and forth between demonstrators and vigilantes and the riot police.
We understand that the reformist government of President Khatami actually is a little dismayed at the protests because while they are looking for reform, they don't want to see the possible backlash from the Ayatollah.
Well, they are afraid that things might turn violent and get out of the control of the reformers.
This has happened once before. Remind us, July 1999, when there were student protests as well?
Yes, and this is the worst street protest since then.
And what happened in 99?
Students protested to the closure of a reformist newspaper. They were attacked by both police and vigilantes. And as a result, one student was killed. Several others were injured. And that led to about a week of demonstration until it was suppressed by the vigilantes.
Yeah. And it was suppressed. Is there a sense that this protest will be suppressed as well?
It's hard to tell. It's definitely not organized. It definitely does not have a leadership. There are more and more people coming out since the first night, but it's hard to predict where it's going to get without a leadership.
It sounds right now like a very sort of amorphous thing, hard to figure out where it's going to go.
Exactly. There are just angry people on the streets every night.
Well, Nazila, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye, Robin.
Nazila Fati, correspondent for The New York Times, speaking to us from Tehran.
While students are fighting for freedom in Iran, women in Iraq are hoping to hold on to theirs. Eileen Prusher writes about some of the new realities for women in post-war Iraq in today's Christian Science Monitor, and she joins us now on the line from Baghdad. Welcome, Eileen.
Thank you.
Eileen, what are some women facing that they didn't face before in Iraq?
It's a variety of things. For starters, there seems to be a lot more pressure on women to wear hijab or some kind of Islamic head covering. And depending on where one is, it could even be more than that. The story that I was just working on focuses on the Shiites asking women to wear the abaya, which is an all-black, much larger piece of sort of all-encompassing coverage. It's not something that, you know, that all women would choose to wear. So that's for starters. Beyond that, I think one of the biggest problems that remains when I speak to women, they say that there's still such a sense of insecurity, a slight sense of anarchy, not really feeling like someone's in charge. I mean, sure, there are U.S. soldiers here, but it's keeping some women young women in particular from being allowed by their families to go out to either jobs or to universities. And there are all these rumors that there are attacks on women and rapes, and it's hard to confirm them. It's a combination of, you know, having a little less freedom, both in terms of dress and in terms of just being able to go about their daily lives.
How angry are women about that, and how does that make them feel about the U.S. troops that are there?
There are quite a few women I've spoken to who are very frustrated with it. Some of the anger is directed towards the U.S. forces because they're asking, well, let's see, under Saddam, we could basically do as we pleased and we dressed as we pleased. I mean, the Ba'athist regime of Saddam Hussein, for all its evils, was basically a secular regime, and that left it possible for women to, join different positions, high positions in society, and sort of wear what they choose. But there are other things as well. I mean, some of the anger I heard was also directed towards some of the religious leadership in Islam, in particular in the Shiites. What we're hearing is that a school of Shiites called the Hawza, they've been sort of imposing, a sort of neo-religious police on various institutions, particularly in universities, going to a mosque, that sort of thing. And they seem to be handing down the law and saying women should dress this way. I've seen signs at universities saying women should not wear pants, they shouldn't wear makeup, they must cover their hair if they're good Muslims. It's a combination of things. You might point to the U.S. for that, but it's also the state of a sort of power vacuum that's continued to exist even a full 2 months or so after the fall of the regime in Baghdad.
Now, the United States is there to create a democracy in Iraq. What would happen if in Iraq Shiite Muslims or Muslims who felt that women should be restricted won an election?
You know, it's perfectly plausible that it could happen. The U.S. has said all along that ultimately the kind of government that Iraqis have in the future is up to the Iraqi people, so long as it's democratic and inclusive and doesn't threaten its neighbors. Iraqis could take cues, for example, from a place like Iran and say, well, we want to have a democracy, but Islam has to play a role since the vast majority of Iraqis are Muslims. And perhaps some kind of democracy based on theocratic Islamic principles could certainly come into play. And I think if that does happen, you know, the U.S. would be sort of hard-pressed to step in and say, well, wait a second, this wasn't exactly the future Iraq that we dreamed of.
Is the U.S. stepping in at all at this point, Eileen, to prevent religious authorities from enforcing religious restrictions on women?
As far as we can see, no, absolutely not. Some of the places I've visited, I've had some women say to me, well, you know, who put these religious police in charge of this place or that? We don't understand why suddenly they're the ones who are running the show.
Eileen Prusher, thank you so much for joining us from Baghdad.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Eileen Prusher joined us from Baghdad. She writes for the Christian Science Monitor.
An eco-terrorist group called the Earth Liberation Front has claimed responsibility for setting fire to luxury homes under construction in Michigan and California to protest urban sprawl. The underground group split off from the more mainstream Earth First in 1992. Followers have vandalized SUVs, destroyed equipment in logging camps, and spiked trees, which can kill a person who later tries to cut the tree down. No one has been killed yet. Joining us on the line is Bruce Barcott. He's contributing editor for Outside Magazine. And Bruce, how did all this start?
Well, it's interesting. The ELF started in the mid-90s with tree spiking and lighting a few Forest Service vehicles and offices on fire, mainly in Oregon and a little bit in Northern California. But sometime around the late 90s, and a lot of people mark it with the Big Vail Fire. I think it was in 1998 when a huge million-dollar lodge that was being built by the Vail Ski Resort was burned down. And after that, they've really spread out from forest issues to taking on really any symbol of modern civilization gone awry.
By the way, what is spiking trees? I mean, literally putting spikes in the tree?
Literally, yeah, putting a ceramic or a metal spike in a tree so that when it goes through the sawmill, the blade hits the spike and sometimes literally shatters. Mm-hmm. I think there was one major injury caused by tree spiking back in the 90s or so.
Well, Bruce, you've spoken to some of these members both in jail for some of their crimes and in these loose meetings, because it's a very loose, tight-lipped membership. Do you ask them, do they see any difference between themselves and a guy who burns down a health clinic because he opposes abortion?
The ELF members that I've talked to, and I've only talked to a couple of them, one is actually in jail right now for burning a couple cars in an Oregon car lot. And he really saw the issue in terms of the species extinction and the environment coming to an end if we don't do anything about it. And I think he and other members of ELF start off doing tree sits and things like that.
But it's one thing to sit in a tree to try to save the
exactly, exactly.
To save the
and then, and then, you know, what happens sometimes is you, after sitting in a tree for a year or two, you see that really nothing is happening. If you get a little frustrated and you decide, well, I'm going to try something a little more extreme.
Well, as you write in your terrific article in Outside Magazine, you know, there's an element of why now. It's the most environmentally enlightened time, at least relative to 30 years ago. And there's no tolerance for terrorism. And there's an irony that you have someone like Arianna Huffington, an extremely wealthy Republican operative who's now leading the fight against SUVs, and some of these eco-terrorists are sitting in jail. It's not as if they're having an impact.
Right. You know, in their own warped way, some of the elves are, you know, in the vanguard. They're ahead of these issues.
But I guess my question is, I mean, it just doesn't seem as if the violence is getting the same attention as the nonviolent approach. I mean, do you question
right.
them on
no,
that?
I agree. No, I agree. I think they, you know, what they do is undermine basically the moral pedestal upon which the environmental movement stands. And I don't think it's working.
Well, and you've said that they feel that they are saving the earth, but you've talked to terrorism experts as well. Is there a fear of how far they will go?
There is a fear that basically people will start getting killed. And some of their leaders, you know, there's a fellow named Craig Rosebrough, who was sort of has been the mouthpiece for a number of years. And in talking with him a couple times, including I talked to him a few weeks after 9/11, and he was seriously reconsidering the whole concept of nonviolence and was, you know, arguing for the legitimacy of armed struggle. And you see that point of view coming out more and more in the sorts of articles that are written either by ELF members or folks who are sympathetic to ELF members.
Mm. Well, Bruce, thank you so much.
You bet.
Bruce Barcott, contributing editor for Outside Magazine, talking to us about the Earth Liberation Front. And just ahead, two war correspondents compare notes. Bill sits down with Christopher Hedges of the New York Times.
And later in the program, the subculture of the spelling bee.
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Sullivan, Weinstein and McQuay, a Boston law firm committed to finding direct, efficient solutions to legal problems for businesses and institutions, online at swmlawyers.com. And Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, serving home-style Persian cuisine for lunch Monday through Friday and dinner nightly. Reservations online at lalaroqh.com. 58 degrees, overcast skies in Boston. The time is 12:20. Mary Crow talks about why she chose WBUR when considering which institutions to support with a major gift.
I decided to give what for me is a pretty significant amount of money because BUR is an important factor in my life and in my understanding of the world and my access to information that I really value.
To become a member of WBUR's Leadership Circle, call 617-353-1151.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Most how-to books tell you how to, excuse me, garden or fix your bicycle. But New York Times writer Chris Hedges has now written a book that's called What Every Person Should Know About War. And it's a kind of how-to book on becoming a soldier, survival in a combat zone, and how to cope if someone you know doesn't survive a combat zone. It's a nuts and bolts book about the reality of war by a correspondent who's covered conflict since the 1980s. And joining us now on the line is Chris Hedges. Hello, Chris. Chris, thanks very much for joining us. And I guess I should mention to our audience that you and I are old colleagues who've covered a lot of the same stuff over the years.
Yeah.
You know, Chris, this new book, What Every Person Should Know About War, is, it's a strange book at first glance. Why did you write this book?
Well, it's part of, you know, I think one of the frustrations that many of us who've covered conflicts feel when we come back is going up against the myth of war. And I wanted very much to reach out to people who have very basic questions about war, what it does to you, how long you can stand sustained combat, what happens to you afterwards, how the Army creates more efficient killers, and put it in a very kind of in a manual type form. But everything is sourced and taken essentially from military studies, which began in earnest after the end of the Second World War.
Some of it, Chris, does have a funny ring to it at times. For example, how can I avoid being shot by the enemy? That's the question in bold type. Answer, avoid being seen, rely on camouflage, physical defenses, and the cover of darkness, stay low to the ground, and it kind of goes on. Are you aware that there's a tone in here at times that almost does seem kind of simplistic?
Yes, I think it does seem simplistic. I think it's often deceiving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, all of us who've spent a lot of time in combat have these kinds of questions. These are the questions that very rarely get answered, if
mm-hmm.
they get asked. And we tried to pick, and I worked with a lot of veterans on this. There were about 20 people who worked with me on the book, four of whom graduated from West Point. A couple people were in Vietnam, more than a couple. And we really tried to ask the kinds of questions that young people who are about to go into war ask.
You've talked about recently in several contexts the unreality of a war that's primarily presented to many on television. To read this book is very much to come away with a sense of the reality of war. How important was that to you?
Well, that was really why I wrote it. I wanted the military to explain it to you. Some of the stuff, while it's sort of written in a very dry tone, is staggering in its implications. I mean, for instance, we had a question, what will happen if I am exposed to nuclear radiation but do not die immediately? And we just quoted directly from the Office of the Surgeon General's textbook of military medicine, which says, fatally irradiated soldiers should receive every possible palliative treatment, including narcotics, to prolong their utility and alleviate their physical and psychological distress. Depending on the amount of fatal radiation, such soldiers may have several weeks to live and to devote to the cause. Commanders and medical personnel should be familiar with estimating survival time based on onset of vomiting. Physicians should be prepared to give medications to alleviate diarrhea and to prevent infection and other sequelae of radiation sickness in order to allow the soldier to serve as long as possible. The soldier must be allowed to make the full contribution to the war effort. He will already have made the ultimate sacrifice. He deserves a chance to strike back and to do so while experiencing as little discomfort as possible.
Do you think that military officers are going to pick up this book? An officer has already been through extraordinarily extensive training by the time he's on the battlefield.
I think this is probably not geared towards the officers. It's probably geared toward the enlisted or geared towards those who have questions about what military life is like and are not in the military. One of the Jack Wheeler, who was went to West Point, served in Vietnam, and really worked quite closely with me on the book, said he felt that the primary audience would end up being mothers, mothers who would probably end up giving it to their children.
Hmm. Chris, why are you writing so much about war?
Well, because I spent so much of my life in war. I bear the demons of war, and I also bear the frustration of watching this kind of flag-waving jingoism, the abstract terms of glory, honor, heroism, terms that are rendered hollow, if not obscene, in combat.
Are you a journalist anymore, Chris? Can you be?
Well, I think that a good journalist is always strives towards the truth, and that's essentially what I'm doing. there's not a line of rhetoric in this book at all.
You gave a speech at Rockford College in late May talking about the Iraq War. War, we have come to believe, you say at one point in that speech, is a spectator sport. You were practically booed off the stage. How are you feeling about all that at this point?
Well, you know, I looked out on that crowd, and it was the same crowd I'd seen in Belgrade or Buenos Aires or innumerable other places. I mean, it's that kind of intoxication of patriotism. It's an emotional response, that kind of emotional need to identify with a cause, identify with the state, especially in wartime, that sense of personal empowerment that comes with identifying with the power of the state. You know, these are all things that often blind us to the reality of war itself. So I think my personal reaction was one of sadness to see this within my own country, but at the same time, I wasn't surprised. It's something I've seen in conflict after conflict.
War is not something you completely rule out. The classic example, you would have fought a war to deprive Hitler of Europe.
Well, you know, yes, and not only that. I mean, war is always tragic, and violence always distorts individuals and societies. But there are times that, you know, violence becomes inevitable. I mean, sitting around Sarajevo, for instance, under Serbian guns with 1,000 to 2,000 shells a day, 4 to 5 dead a day, 2 dozen wounded a day, there were not a lot of people huddled in those apartments having long discussions about whether they should be pacifists or not.
A book about the reality of war. It's called What Every Person Should Know About War, and it's written by Chris Hedges, who's been our guest. Chris, thanks very much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks.
Next week on Here and Now, we'll explore if nastiness on the Internet is getting worse.
And the independent record labels. Business is very brisk.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by M. Steinhardt & Sons, Massachusetts' only authorized Steinway dealer, featuring Steinway and other pianos for all musical taste and budgets. Location information at msteinhardt.com. By Creative Catering in Somerville, providing distinctive food for any event. Catering menus are available at 617-666-4366. And by World Music, presenting Flamenco Republic with Maria Pacas and 15 dancers and musicians from Spain, June 19th through the 22nd at the Emerson Majestic Theater, worldmusic.org. Off and on rain throughout the day today, cooler highs near 60 degrees. It is 58 degrees in Boston at 1229.
Sylvia Pagioli reporting on the Palio, a spectacular parade and horse race steeped in tradition.
What is about to begin is not a sporting event, but a long-cherished battle. The jockeys race bareback, viciously fast for 3 laps on the beaten earth around the uneven shell-shaped Campo, the most dangerous track in the world. The winner is often not the best, but a survivor. Every dirty trick is allowed.
Don't miss your chance to join Sylvia Pagioli at this summer's Palio, one of the amazing stops on our next Citizens of the World tour to Tuscany and Umbria. Call 800-909-9287.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, coming up, did journalists ask the right questions about weapons of mass destruction before the war in Iraq began?
And we review the new edge-of-your-seat thriller about the National Spelling Bee.
I don't know what happened. Maybe I blanked out. Maybe the pressure was getting to be too much. But I asked whether it had anything to do with the word Corolla. Does it have to do with, like, a Corolla?
What's a Corolla?
I don't know, like the car.
These stories coming up here and now.
Good afternoon. I'm Dolores Handy. Deadly U.S. battles against opposition forces continue in Iraq. The military says U.S. forces killed 27 Iraqi fighters in a ground and air pursuit today after the Iraqis attacked an American tank patrol. That brings the opposition death toll in 4 days of skirmishes to about 100. A military spokesman says 6 American soldiers have been wounded in the past 24 hours in fighting across Iraq. Israel said today it will wage a war to the bitter end against Hamas. A security official says Israel's military will now target all leaders of Hamas for assassination, even the group's spiritual leader. The source says the Israeli military activated contingency plans for hunting down the top men after Hamas rejected ceasefire talks. This, as an opinion poll showed, a majority of Israelis oppose the stepped-up attacks on leaders of the Islamic militant group. Secretary of State Colin Powell says despite this week's violence, both sides have told him they are still committed to the roadmap to Mideast peace.
We have a plan. We have the commitment of leaders. And now we have to execute that plan and keep moving forward and not allow ourselves to be distracted or thrown off point from the promise that's out there with the roadmap.
This week has been especially violent. 4 Israeli strikes killed 20 Palestinians, and a Palestinian suicide bomber killed 17 people Wednesday on a Jerusalem bus. Another terrorist-related arrest in Thailand. Police there say they've taken a man into custody who was trying to sell radioactive material, like the kind that can be used to make a so-called dirty bomb. U.S. investigators reportedly tipped off local police who arrested one man for possession of nuclear materials. Earlier this week, 3 people were arrested in southern Thailand and accused of plotting attacks on embassies and tourist spots. Some good news coming from the World Health Organization about the SARS virus. The agency has dropped some parts of China from its list of areas where people are being advised not to travel to because of SARS. The WHO still has not put Toronto back on the travel warning list, despite a U.S. traveler who recently caught the disease there before returning home. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 93 points at 9102. The Nasdaq is down 24 points at 1628. And the S&P is down 11 at 998. This is Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Chobi Hoy Associates, previous winner of the TAB's Reader's Choice Award for 4 consecutive years, offering real estate consultation for sales or rentals, 617-739-0067. Schneider Leasing Company, providing short-term computer rental services for conferences, conventions, and special events, 617-261-6060. And TechFusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialist. TechFusion helps prevent data disasters from happening now and in the future. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. Interleague play continues for the Red Sox tonight when former Sox manager Jimmy Williams and his Houston Astros visit Fenway Park. It's the first game of a 3-game weekend series. And Game 5 of the NBA Finals is tonight. The series between the New Jersey Nets and the San Antonio Spurs is tied at 2 wins each. Rain in the forecast into tonight. Tonight, highs near 60.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
So few of us end up really helping create something in our lives that wasn't there before we showed up. David Brinkley did. He was there when one of the first TV cameras was wheeled into NBC News. His style from the anchor desk gave the still new job of presenting news on television a whole new energy. And that style came with substance. A rare enough combination in television news these days, some would say. Just this week, as David Brinkley left the scene, questions surfaced as to whether journalists sufficiently challenged the Bush administration on its claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Well, joining us on the line now to discuss style and substance are Guy McMillan, who's editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Hello, Guy.
Hi, Bill.
And Randy Wilson, editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Bill.
Randy, Brinkley was NBC's first White House correspondent, yet he once said he probably couldn't get a job on TV today. What do you make of that?
He was probably right. I mean, he was smart, he was witty, and he knew his his sources, those aren't qualities that anchors really need nowadays. And I think the era of David Brinkley, John Chancellor, Walter Cronkite has passed actually about 10 or 15 years ago and isn't coming back on an entertainment-valued TV news shows nowadays.
Guy, is the 6:30 newscast that David Brinkley epitomized a thing of the past?
I'm afraid it may be. I hate to see it go, but I don't think that says much about David Brinkley. He was really less known for the substance of his work than for the style of it, I think.
Yeah. Randy, has it become on television, in news, all about style now?
Well, I think the fact that you have news shows now that are news magazines, you have shows in the morning hosted by folks who are perky, as they say about Katie Couric, has almost acclimated viewers to wanting more than just the hard news, and I just think that's the wave of the future.
Mm-hmm.
I think you ought to say something about Brinkley's writing style, which was at the time unique. Brinkley started writing for the ear, you know, with these short, simple, declarative sentences that really looked awfully thin on paper, but they really came alive when he barked them out over the air in his inimitable style.
Writing is not the first priority when a young journalist is hired by a local television station these days. But let's talk a moment then, moving on. A very important question of substance is whether journalists were tough enough on the Bush administration. People are talking about this week, whether journalists were tough enough about challenging the Bush administration on its claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Randy, what do you think?
I think in hindsight, the answer is yes. I mean, the administration has not been able to show us the evidence, and it really, I think, has damaged our credibility. It also, I think, damages the credibility of editors and publishers who seem to spend so much time planning to get reporters on the ground to embed them when they really should have been burrowing into the State Department and into military sources to get their own affirmation of this kind of evidence.
Well, I don't know. I guess that's a point. I hate to blame the journalistic profession for the fact that George Bush and his administration overpromised on weapons of mass destruction. That wasn't my fault. As far as asking questions goes, the questions were asked. They were answered. They apparently were answered incorrectly. We don't know whether they were answered dishonestly. We'll find that out after a while, I guess. But other than columnists and editorial writers, I don't know what a journalist is supposed to do. You don't run up to Donald Rumsfeld and begin shaking him when he gives you an answer you don't like.
So you're saying, Guy, that the administration holds all the cards?
Yeah. I mean, if they tell you that they have evidence of this, what are you going to do? It's a matter of faith, isn't it? They told us some things that have so far proved to be incorrect. And nobody seems to mind very much. This is a huge scandal in other parts of the world, but Americans are more or less sanguine about it, I think, right now.
Well, Randy, there were people like Scott Ritter. He's almost a bad word to bring up in certain circles, who were challenging whether Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. There was a lot of stuff on the Internet challenging that. But I didn't hear a lot of challenges with that sort of information directly in the face of, say, Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, there's the old dictum, trust but verify, and I think it really comes down to who has access to classified documents in a real time, and it just needs to be reassessed whether the way we cover the military-industrial complex needs to rely now on lower-level functionaries who have that access, who are willing to at least give an opinion about it, even if they don't share it, and balance that with the need for national security.
Let me tell you what I think the long-term scandal is going to be. It's not going to be whether or not the president lied. It's going to be what happens the next time we have to, or someone tells us we have to engage in a military expedition. People are going to say, oh, is that based on that intelligence of the type that we had about Iraq?
But, Guy, if you're saying that journalists did what they could last time, but now you're saying they will be tougher should, for example, military action in Iran come up, isn't that, in effect, saying they could have been tougher as far as weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
No, I don't think journalists will be tougher. I mean, to talk about responsible journalism, we asked the right questions, I think, and we got declarative answers, and they turned out to be wrong. Next time, we'll ask the same questions, but I think our audience will be a little more skeptical.
What troubles me, I guess, is that we have spent in the past decade as journalists seeming to go to a lot of trouble to find out about you know, which intern is sleeping with the president and who's cooking the books. But when it comes down to a life or death issue like going to war, we as an establishment, that is a journalism, didn't seem to really want to do the job to get at the right answers.
Mm-hmm. Anything going on locally, you guys, that we ought to know about, stepping off the vast international geopolitical subjects that we sometimes veer upon?
Well, we're being sapped up here in Flagstaff. We have the invasion of the aphids in the pine trees, excreting sap so thick you can't even open your car doors sometimes.
Oh.
And they're, in fact, being munched on by ladybugs so loudly that some people say they're being kept awake at night.
Well, what the heck brought that on?
We're still in drought here. The Southwest really is suffering, and it's not that funny a story. We have sheep and cattle ranchers are really in trouble, and the stressed pine trees just can't fight off this series of pests.
Drought, Guy. Did you hear that word?
I did.
Do you have that problem in New Hampshire?
I can announce here formally today that the drought is over in New Hampshire, and New Hampshire crops for the summer will not be the traditional corn on the cob and tomatoes, but we're planting rice here.
We're going to need an ark in the Northeast pretty soon just to get to work.
Yes.
It's an incredible rainy season. And maybe people in the rest of the country are sick of hearing about the East Coast problems with rain, but it has been extraordinary, right, Guy?
Well, when we float away, they'll miss us in the rest of the country.
They will. And we will miss you until next time, Randy Wilson and Guy McMillan. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Guy McMillan is editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire.
For 40 days, 40 long nights, I never seen rain like it. It looked like our old friend was being pulled right. We had no time to worry, though there was just too much to do between the signified monkey and the kangaroo.
Still to come, a spelling bee champ helps us review a film about the mother of all spelling bees.
You're listening to Here and Now. So, a few weeks after the Memorial Day weekend Orange Alert ended, remember that? We get a country obsessed with Hillary. Hillary seemed to be everywhere this week. On all known media. And the hype seemed to work, her books breaking nonfiction records. And in New York, people lined up at midnight to be the first to buy Living History, which I don't get. In fact, I made a bet with my co-host, Robin Young, a week or so ago, that the book would bomb. I will be buying Robin dinner at her earliest convenience. All this hoopla for a book which, according to the reviews I've read, is a hot seller that's not all that hot. It said, Hillary's dignified throughout and intelligent and dispenses homespun wisdom. But she also apparently leans much more in the direction of being high and mighty than down and dirty. Now, there may be some readers who rush straight for the book's index to look up Medicare, to get at the former First Lady's reflections on that. But me, well, I'd want more gossip, a few offhand smears, a little rage, maybe a previously undisclosed war council with a posse of divorce lawyers. I'd need that sort of thing to buy this book. Here's the way the math works out for me. You pay $28, she makes $8 million, and it's, at best, PG-13. But maybe I'm missing the point. Maybe what's at play here is nostalgia for the Clintons, and especially for that summer when all we talked about was Monica. Now, over that Orange Alert weekend I just mentioned, Memorial Day weekend, I took a walk with a friend in Lower Manhattan. It was a misty Sunday under gray, eerie skies. Now, my friend, let's call him Tom, told me he was nervous about buying an apartment in the city because, he said, he feared a radiological bomb, which is how he said it, a radiological bomb, which could cause radiation, which could linger for generations. And that, Tom said, would wreck real estate values. A gray day in New York, under Orange Alert, talking about a nuclear bomb and real estate values. That's a long way from that golden summer of Monica, when the economy was great and all we ever seemed to talk about, in one way or another, was sex. You know, in a way, the Monica Follies and the continuing saga of the Clintons had everything to do with life. Life, no doubt, at its most ridiculous and messy and even mean. But it was not about the apocalypse. Maybe we miss Hillary and Bill and Monica, an old Ken Starr. And maybe the book brings it back. Sure, the reviews I've read say Hillary's living history doesn't amount to much. But these days, maybe everything else just seems like too much.
I smell sex and can they hear? Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah, mama, this must be my dream.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Innuendo, offering decorating solutions to help meet their clients' needs, featuring shutters in wood or thermalite and silk or sheer panels from around the world. By 10,000 Villages in Cambridge and Brookline, a nonprofit gift shop featuring fairly traded items from 30 countries, 10,000villages.org. Your purchase makes a difference. And Creative Catering in Somerville, providing distinctive food for any event. Catering menus are available at 617-666-4366. We'd like to thank TechFusion.com, Lori DeSantis Photography, and Dover Rug Company for helping make our online auction a success. And thank you for making a bid for the news. 58 degrees, overcast skies in Boston right now. The time is 12:48.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The word is bands.
With a D sound or without a D sound? You said it's a homonym, and you told me what it means, but am I allowed to ask what its homonym means? All right, I'm starting over. B-A-N-D... What I have so far is B-A-N-D. I don't know if that was a great idea, but... Oops, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Oh, well.
That's Harry, one of the eight kids profiled in the new documentary, Spellbound. His word, bands, is defined in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary as a public pronouncement, especially in church, of a proposed marriage. Well, we won't tell you if he got it right, but here's a hint. Afterwards, his Jewish mother said, if only we were Catholic. I feel sorry for the kid from Texas who got Yenta. Well, for Harry and the other 247 contestants at the 1999 National Spelling Bee in Washington, D.C., one word can make or break you. 9 million kids compete in spelling competitions around the country every year, and our guest reviewer this week was one of them. In 1992, Matthew Lawrence won for the city of Cranston, Rhode Island, and he went on to the States. And what happened at the States, Matthew?
I lost towards the end, but...
Oh, what word?
Hurdle.
Spell it.
H-U-R-T-L-E.
Yeah. Well, Matthew, you got further than any of us did in even competing. So you're a winner on our eyes, and we welcome you to join Here and Now's regular film reviewers, Eric Schaefer and Renee Graham, to talk about the new film, Spellbound. Welcome to you both as well.
Hi, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, Matthew, back to just a little bit of your story. You were just a little younger than the 12 to 14-year-olds in the film Spellbound when you competed. You were 11 and in the sixth grade.
Right.
So tell me, did it capture what you know happens at these events?
Yeah, I think it did. I think that the level of excitement was captured pretty well. I obviously didn't get to the Nationals. I'm sure there's a huge jump in excitement just from traveling to get there and being around hundreds of other easily excitable parents. And
by the way, how did you spell hurdle?
I spelled it with a D.
Oh, boy.
I was thinking of the hurdles you jump over and hurdle like
who
the
wouldn't
other.
Have done that? Well, the film has been getting great buzz and reviews. It's being called a thriller.
And I can't imagine it wouldn't be. Renee, I watch the competition when they air in June on ESPN. I watch it every year.
It's more suspenseful than any spelling bee has any right to be, because they're kids and you want them to do well and you're rooting with them and you see the parents are sweating it out. And it's delightful, but it's also just a really good film. It's a lot of fun.
I don't know what happened. Maybe I blanked out. Maybe the pressure was getting to be too much. But I asked whether it had anything to do with the word Corolla.
Does it have to do with, like, a Corolla?
What's a Corolla?
I don't know, like the car.
Well, Eric, originally the filmmakers followed 12 competitors. They ended up including 8. So those poor other 4, not only did they not, you know, win the spelling bee, but they got cut from the film. But that's still a lot of characters to get to know. Did they work as characters?
Yeah, each one of these kids has a very distinctive personality. And the first half of the film is really sort of set up to establish these kids, who they are, where they're from. You get an idea of their parents and so on. So the film starts out with one girl, Angela, who is from Texas, and she's the daughter of Mexican immigrants.
They're just so proud that, I mean, they didn't come over here for nothing. They thought we would have better educational opportunities over here, and I guess it has all been worth it for them.
And then you have all these other kids who come from very diverse backgrounds. You have Ashley, who lives with her mother in the projects in Washington, D.C. You have a girl named Emily, who's from a rather well-to-do family in Connecticut. And so we see these sort of differences in class and in attitude toward not only the spelling bee, but toward education and toward living in this country.
The first year we went, we brought the au pair as well. We brought Claudia from Germany. And last year, I was just like, when we had to fill out a form to say who we're going to bring, I was like, Mom, you forgot the au pair. You forgot Marie, who was our then au pair. And she's like, well, I don't think we're going to bring the au pair this year. And I'm like, why not? You know, but then we went, and it was like a family thing. It was like a real time to be with my mom and my dad, and it was nice.
Also, it represents how the spelling bee represents something different for the parents as well. For the girl, Ashley, who lives in D.C. with her single mother, it's scholarship money. You know, for Angela, who lives in Texas, her parents are Mexican immigrants who never learned to speak English, even though they've been here for years and years. And seeing their daughter get to this level represents real success for them, that their daughter has managed to accomplish this in America.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see also how the kids react, but also how their parents react to this, which is the sort of other piece of the movie.
Was there a little bit of the beauty pageant aspect to it, you know, the too pushy parent?
It wasn't as freakish. I mean, there were moments I kept thinking of this documentary from a few years ago called Living Dolls, which was about child beauty pageants, and that was really unnerving and unsettling and freakish. It wasn't that bad, but you know, you could see little bits and pieces of that little league parent syndrome of the parents just almost sort of riding these kids to get things right. One boy in particular, Neil, who's from San Clemente, California, his parents just would be like firing words at him, and it just meant so much to them. And you could just, the movie doesn't really get into that, but it felt like the parents wanted this more than necessarily he did.
In the final days of the competition, we were doing between 7,000 to 8,000 words a day.
Very good.
Sacrosanct.
S-A-C-R-O-S-A-N-C-T.
Sacrosanct means mostly holy, overly scared. Sardion.
S-A-R-D-I-O-N.
What we do is to...
And the thing is that the filmmaker Jeffrey Blitz could have taken some real easy shots, both at the parents and at some of the kids as well. The girl from Connecticut, you know, probably with a little more judicious editing, could have come off as really snooty and you know, self-involved. And by the end of the movie, she seems, you know, just as normal as the rest of them. And so, you know, I think Blitz is to be commended for not taking the cheap shots and not taking the easy way out.
Well, Matthew, tell me, what was your reason for getting into spelling bees? I mean, what did it offer for you?
It wasn't something where I'm from that you get into. It was more something that they automatically had them in the classroom, and then from the classroom you had the school and with all the classes in the school, and then...
So you got swept along in it.
So, yeah, it just sort of progressed. It wasn't that I said, oh, I'm going to sit down and memorize the dictionary. Like, a lot of these kids did.
And it becomes this big event for these kids as well, because they're, you know, traveling, it's a lot of these cases, from small towns to Washington, D.C. You know, the final day is televised live on ESPN, so it becomes this big deal. But I think all of that adds this incredible pressure, too, because they, especially for the kids from these small towns where the schools are rooting for them and, you know, the local store has their name up, you know, congratulations, Emily, good luck. And it is this sort of pressure-packed thing, although, as Eric mentioned, Blitz doesn't really, that's not really the point here. He's not trying to make some big sociological statement about, you know, competition in children.
It sounds like it's like the Rocky of spelling bees, which, how great is that? I mean, that's a great thing, right, Eric, to sort of, for kids to see?
Well, yeah, I think it is a very affirmative movie. It's and even though some of the kids themselves may be a little ambivalent about spelling and the art of spelling and so on, you do get a sense of commitment and the interest in learning and so on. And that's something that is just so rare to see in movies these days.
Matthew, one last question to you. As you said, you were sort of in the swim of the spelling bee stream that your school and your city, Cranston, Rhode Island, had. But these kids in the film, apparently one of the Indian kids, was it? His parents hired 1,000 people in India to pray
for him. That's Neil.
Well, what did you do, Matthew?
I remember being taken out of class to have the principal give me words and have me spell them. But I was in the spelling bee. I was also in the geography bee and the math team and the academic decathlon teams.
Well, I guess, is there a sense of, you know, hey, one for our team? There's a movie out for our team.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think the movie presented the kids well, and even Harry, the really, I don't know.
You were going to say geeky, weren't
you? Yes. Even Harry, by the end of the movie, you kind of see where he's coming from, at least.
And rooting for him.
Yeah.
Well, at the very least, something to cheer for in the new film Spellbound. So thanks, all of you, for coming in to tell us about it.
Thanks, Robin.
And our guest reviewer for the new documentary Spellbound was Matthew Lawrence. He won for the city of Cranston, Rhode Island in 1992 and went on to the state competition where he was knocked out by the word hurdle. Eric Schaefer, film historian who also teaches at Emerson College in Boston, and Renee Graham is pop culture correspondent for the Boston Globe.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Kako, Karen Miller-Metzen, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna, and our editor is Mitch Wortley.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Boris Strapachki. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Lindsay Crudell and Allison Vence.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
Have a great weekend, and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at MathWorks.com. This MathWorks.com. This